Accession number 19391, Reel 3.
Harry Jones, Reel 3. You were just about to tell me what happened to you after you'd done this job as coxswain to Captain D.
Well, I then joined the Malcolm at Devonport in, which was a clan-class destroyer. Beg your pardon, wasn't a clan-class destroyer. I just forget now. Memory's gone.
It was a destroyer.
It was a destroyer.
Never mind the clan.
And she was having a refit in Devonport, and I just joined. And the first job I got, the buffer came to me, he said, "All right, you're a new hand." He said, "The first job you can do is to paint the topmast." So I thought, well, that's a good beginning, that, you know. And that broke me in, that did. Anyway, I was made leading seaman of one mess then. And we sailed on convoy work in the North Atlantic for quite a long time, and the conditions was very, very bad. The food only lasted, or the fresh food only lasted for 3 or 4 days. She was a very old destroyer, built in 1919, and no fridges as such on. And used to carry enough vegetables and such like, potatoes. And when you got in bad weather, you had what you call canteen messing then. By that I mean you provided most of the food yourself, and you bought the food from the naffy, carried it with you, and took it along to be prepared at the galley. And then it was up to you what you made of it. But the mess decks was the worst. In heavy weather, there was always 3 or 4 inches of water on the mess decks, and the potatoes and sprouts and cabbages and all this smelt more like a horse's stable closed in during the night than how the crews managed to, I won't say put up with it, exist in it. It was, conditions was absolutely terrible. And if you was at sea more than 10 to 14 days, you went on hardtack and corn dog. That probably was the worst of the wartime conditions. It was very, very bad.
Did you join this ship in 41 or 42?
41, sometime 41, I think.
So you were in North Atlantic work?
All North Atlantic a lot. And we would then go to Jib, do a convoy, if you'll say, from the Western Approaches to Jib. And then down the West African coast, carrying the big troop ships, which was going around to the Middle East. Couldn't get through the Med then very well with big convoys. And we were on that run from Cape St. Vincent down to the equator, or that whereabouts, for a long time. And then we'd occasionally come back up north and do a Iceland-Russian run.
Yes, you were telling me about the different places the Malcolm operated in.
Well, we got around quite a lot in the Malcolm. We didn't seem to be tied up to any flotilla or anything, but whenever anything out of the ordinary was going to happen, we always seemed to get involved in it. We had probably one of the best skippers of the war in escort work. Anyway, it was Commander Russell, who was the Duke of Bedford. It was very comical sometime. When the mail was brought aboard, we had an A.B. Russell, a three-badge A.B. And I think his mail got mixed up with Archie's, who was the skipper. But he was a first-class seaman. Very, very good.
You mean he had a sense of humour?
Yes, he had a sense of humour. He was a really an RN skipper of the best quality.
Any incidents that you remember concerning him?
Not personally. He wasn't a bloke who got very involved with the crew. We did see a lot of action in the Malcolm. We multi convoys and North Ram and the Boom at Algiers and PQ-18 convoy to Russia.
Can you tell me about ramming the boom at Algiers, please?
Well, it first started the buzzes rolling when we were in Liverpool, and Sir Max Horton came aboard and started inspecting different things, and we were then sent to Alka Rifle Range to do a commando course. We weren't told anything at all what was going to happen, but we'd done this few days at Alka, and
where's Alka?
Alka is Royal Engineers Range at Alka outside Liverpool Seaforth. That's where all the army used to do the working up trials and such like. Anyway. We knew something had happened, because when we came, we were billeted in huts in Liverpool. When we came back, the ship had been altered tremendously. She had big steel plates put round the side, the guard rails, and splinter matting round the wheelhouse, and trench mortars on the bows, and all sorts of things like that. Anyway, after all these alterations, we went to Belfast then. Got a few more alterations put on. Then all of a sudden a lot of army wagons started pulling up alongside, and American personnel soldiers started coming aboard, and we thought, what the hell's going on here? We're going to invade Southern Ireland or somewhere. No one would say anything at all. You couldn't get any information whatsoever what was going on. And eventually these soldiers were bunched in almost every convenient spot on the ship. And he counted them all out, and we got 500 aboard. And within a minute or two after all this had been done, they all marched off again in the lorries and beat it. We just couldn't understand. Anyway, we got ready for sea and we sailed. Forgot all about the soldiers, never thought any more about it. And we were taking the convoy then. It was one of the biggest convoys I could remember then. We'd escorted it down to Gib. And got into Gib, and there was every conceivable naval ship in Gib then. There was, I think it was, five or six aircraft carriers, battleships. Everything you mentioned was in there. And it was obvious something big was going to happen. We still didn't know what was going to happen, and we thought we were either going to invade Spain. It's laughable now, but at the time we just didn't know. Anyway, we were in the training and learning how to climb up, throwing hand grapnels up onto these aircraft carriers and hoisting ourselves up on them and climbing aboard, and we just didn't know. Then, at about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, it was dark, the skipper, who was Commander Russell, cleared lower decks, and he said, I suppose you've all been wondering what's going to happen. He said, well, I'll tell you now, because no man is going ashore after this now. He said, we're sailing such and such a time. He says, we're going to invade North Africa, and our job with HMS Broke is to ram the boom at Algiers, and we've got to try and stop the French scuttling the ships, and we're going to invade. So that was that. So as I said, we sailed at about midnight, got into the Mediterranean, and was in the biggest armada of ships I could remember. There was hundreds. And we sailed then through the Med, and at about 4 or 5 o'clock the following day, HMS Sheffield came up on the scene. The Broke went one side of her, and we went the other side, and we both took 500 American Rangers aboard. We carried on sailing. The skipper had cleared lower deck again, or at least given the messages right round to say that we were going to invade Algiers, as he'd said, and the signal was going to be if the Free French had refused to surrender, the searchlights would be looking for us and they would fire on us. If they capitulated, the searchlight would be put straight up in the air. Anyway, that was that. But mixed in with these American Rangers, there was quite a lot of the Royal Marines. And we, when we got close into Algiers, we took the white ensign down and we put the American flag up. The reason for this, it was said that the French might be more sympathetic against the Americans than they were against us, because we'd bomb them at different places, and at Dakar in North Africa we'd had a go at them and they didn't like it. But anyway, we went in, the Broke was leading, I think she was senior to us, and by this time I was a PO then, and I was put in charge of the after end of the ship, fire parties and such like. And anyway, as we couldn't see the shore at all of a sudden a searchlight came on. We must have been only a few hundred yards off the beach or something, or the docks, and the searchlight kept shining on us and missed the Broke. Broke was leading us, and she got past us. And all of a sudden, they started opening up, and our orders were to fire and try and put the searchlight out, or the two or three searchlights going then, which we didn't succeed straight away. Anyway, in the meantime, the French had opened up on us, and we were taking quite a bit of a hammering then. Shrapnel had hit midships on the Malcolm, and most of the American ammunition was on our midship decks. That's the decks between the two funnels, where the two guns were, and it was all piled high, and this started going off, which wasn't very nice. And I'll always remember, by this time we were on fire, I was in charge of one fire party, and we got things moving. There's a lad called, I think his name was Furhurst, I've always remembered it, and he was throwing these boxes of ammunition. He was a big lad, about 6 foot odd, fit as a fiddle, and he was throwing these ammunition boxes, which you've got to remember that the American ammunition was in 1,000 round ammunition, and ours were in 500 round ammunition. You with me? Ours was only half the weight of the Americans, and he was throwing these 1,000 boxes over the side. Anyway, we did hear afterwards that he lost his leg through that. But anyway, one of the French shells, and it was quite a big shell, we did hear afterwards, a 9-inch, but may not have been, hit the forward boiler room, went right through our port side below the waterline. Blew the forward boiler room up, but didn't explode. With a bit of luck, it carried on going, and whatever that is, I don't know. But anyway, unfortunately, we were only by this time doing half the speed. But we should have done, we were supposed to be doing 20 odd knots before when we hit the boom. We hadn't got enough speed to break the boom. This was the theory. So we stopped and we started getting hit quite a few times. And we came out again. But unfortunately, or fortunately, the broke at the time didn't get hit and she got through. With the there was never a boom down, it was up all the time anyway. And she got in. We came out and the Bulolo then, which had been changed from an old days of merchant ship to the operational headquarters. And she was in anchored outside. We were away from Algiers then. And we tied up alongside her, but we were taking so much water in. All the wires we put on were breaking. Now, someone came up, and this is where I done a lot here, was how can we get this hole, which was only just below the waterline? We had our pumps going, and they weren't beating the water. So one of the Yanks, a lot of the Yanks had been killed, incidentally, then. And this hole, as I say, was taking a great deal of water, and it was about nearly a foot wide. And one of the Yanks said, or someone came up with an idea to say, couldn't we get a hammock jammed in it? So Americans volunteered to dive over the side, and we slacked a hammock off and pushed it in the hole. And at the same time, the bosun and myself, and we got all got a working party together, and we shifted all the ammunition off the port side of the Malcolm onto the starboard side. We filled the starboard whaler with water and the starboard motorboat with water. The chief stoker moved all the oil out of the port tanks, and we give it a big list to starboard, and it got the hole virtually above the waterline, or at least on the waterline, and the pumps, the two big pumps that was going, were keeping the water out like, you know. Anyway, while this was going on, the broker got inside, and she was being attacked by the French Foreign Legion then. And we got an order then to get underway again. We'd managed to get something done to the engines, I don't know what. We could do 18 knots then to go and relieve the broke. Anyway, we slipped the wires on the Bulolo and got underway. And just as we were leaving, I think it was the Roberts, a monitor, big 14-inch monitor, was offshore, and she must have either intercepted this signal we got. I was on the bridge at the time when we got this signal, and the yeoman was reading it out like, and my heart went in my boots when we got the signal to say, go and relieve the rope, because he was getting a hammer in. The Roberts says, hold on a minute. So just as the Roberts opened up with the 14-inch guns, there's a big mosque in the entrance to Algiers, and a first salvo blew this mosque to kingdom come like. But a French submarine was coming out at the same time to have a go at us. And she capitulated straight away when the Roberts opened up. Anyway, we started to go into Algiers under our own steam. And Peter Scott, who had come off the broke then, had left the broke and gone on to MTBs. He came in with the MTB flotilla and beat us into Algiers. But there was a little bit of hostilities. I went ashore with a group and we weren't too careful who we made a bit rough on. But anyway, the Stork then, who it ended up after the war, Jimmy the One was the local sea cadet officer, Commander Williams, who took over the local sea cadets at Hoylake. He was the Jimmy the One. Anyway, by this time we were a bit all in, putting it mildly, and the Stork crew were a working party aboard and patched this hole up, and a couple of, well, I think it was The following day we sailed back to Jib with a convoy of 3 ships, and I think we lost 2 of them coming back. One was a Cunard A boat, and eventually got back to Jib.
How long were you ashore in Algiers?
12 hours. Maybe 24 hours.
What were you supposed to be doing?
Well, we went there to take the town over, but they capitulated, you see. And we did know that one of the signals we were we'd been given, if anybody mentioned whiskey, they were friend. And that was the signal we had. We did capture the police station. And they said, well, have a good whiskey. And we knew they were on our side, like, you know. But we weren't in very long. They'd not much heart, the Algiers, then, like, you know. But the broke, she did get it off, but we didn't get involved in her. She sank in the harbour with the French Foreign Legion firing from the warehouse's roof down at her, like, you know. She actually sunk them, I don't know.
But the Malcolm didn't sink?
Oh, no, we got out again, like, you know.
And whilst you were ashore in Algiers, did anybody resist you?
There was a few, yes. And oh, I had a revolver and I fired a few of them. Whether I hit them, I don't know. You've got to remember, it's such a long time now. A lot gets confused when you got the heat of the moment like that.
How big a party were you in when you were ashore in Algiers? About how many of them were there in your party?
There was 6 of us. An officer, myself, and I think it was 6 ratings.
And who was the officer?
It's no good saying now, it's just... They were changing officers a lot on the Malcolm, like, you know.
But he was an officer off Malcolm?
Oh, yes. Don't know who he was, man.
Were there any casualties in your party?
No.
Did you have to fire a weapon at all?
I fired a couple of times, yeah, but not very much, because mostly, I think, the heat of the moment.
Did you hit
anybody? We weren't fired on or anything like that.
Did you hit anybody?
I honestly couldn't say. No record of hitting anybody.
Was it frightening ashore in Algiers?
No. When we first joined the Malcolm, we first went into action. But afterwards, you got climatised to a lot of things. Like, it was the same on the Russian run. You sort of... the first half hour was the worst, and after that, you sort of did get climatised to it. You did on any ship, like, you know.
How did you feel after the Algiers operation?
Well, I think the most trying time of the war on destroyers, on escort destroyers anyway, was waiting for a torpedo to hit you. That seemed to me to be always seemed to be the worst in my mind. Because I remember I was at home, not here, I wasn't married then, and I was on leave. And because my parents made a fuss of me and all that, and they gave me a little bedroom, and it was at the top of the stairs. And my younger brother, who didn't go to the war, he'd been setting some lines on the sandbanks off here for fish. And I said, what time are you going out? And he said, such and such a time, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I said, oh, well, give us a shout and I'll come with you. Well, unknown to me, the little bugger had put the alarm clock in the bedroom. And to this day, I've remembered that day like nothing. What happened was, at, we'll say, 6 o'clock in the morning, the alarm clock went. And I've never been so frightened in all my life. Not the alarm clock going off, but I still thought it was on the Malcolm. And... automatic. You do things by instinct on a destroyer. But you, straight away, you know exactly where you're going, you know exactly what your job is, and you know everything. Well, I went out straight into the wall, cut my head like, you know, and I just didn't know where I was. And in the end, he burst the door open, but in the meantime, my dad had sort of heard the commotion, like, you know, and I went down the stairs, and I fell right down the stairs, you know, just not knowing where I was, like. That was probably the most frightening time I've ever been, like, you know, which had nothing to do with, it was with thinking I was on the ship, like, you know.
Were you in the Malcolm when it was lost?
She wasn't lost, the Malcolm.
But was it torpedoed when you were in the Malcolm?
No, not torpedoed.
But you said you were in PQ-18.
That's the Russian convoy.
What's your memories of being in PQ-18?
Well, that was a bad convoy. That was we been working up for a long time for something like this, and we've been on another convoy, but can't much remember it, because we were brought into a convoy, whether it was PQ-17, but I'm not sure. And we didn't see anything then, but they said there'd been all sorts of ships had been sunk. But anyway, PQ-18, we'd escorted some merchant ship from Lough Ewe in Scotland up to Iceland, and then we'd left Iceland with about, I think it must have been about 40 ships, I think, for Archangel. And about 3 or 4 days out, we started getting all sorts of signals that there was subs around, and this was around, and that was around. And then one particular day, I forget the day, it must have been about 4 or 5 days perhaps after we left. By this time I was a PO, then acting coxswain, I think, on the Malcolm then. And all of a sudden someone said to me, must be firing over there or something. This was on our port bow, and incidentally the Malcolm was the leader of the close escort of the whole convoy then. And that's funny, firing, and we haven't gone to action stations yet. Well, a minute or two later, we went to action stations, and all of a sudden, hell itself let loose. I think we got, if I remember, there was anything up to 60 Henkel bombers coming over then, the convoy. And you might have heard it somewhere, the Golden Comb, they called it, like, you know. This all the torpedo bombers was right round in a big circle, right round the convoy. And I think the first run in, they sank 8 ships. Well-known ships, like, you know. And there was one particular one. I know we were told she had 200 tons of gelignite in it. And she went up. And even then, they picked up 2 survivors. They had survivor ships coming, rescue ships following up, like, which were usually big hull trawler northern boats, like, they had the job of that. And they were flying so low that we were firing at them, and to this day I think we almost hit our own destroyers. It was in the, you know, you're firing horizontally at the torpedo bombers. They were that low at us. And then there was one incident that I think I said. We